Today's program has been brought to you by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. For more information, visit HearstRanch.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Consider the jelly bean. Consider the jelly bean, right. How about the bunny that brought the jelly bean? We're going to talk about this and a whole lot of other sweet things today on A Taste of the Past. Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio, and indeed, jelly beans and Easter bunnies. It is the season. And today I have with me to talk about all these sweet things, Michael Crandall. And Michael is a teaching instructor, a writer, an author, a lecturer. He's the author of The Taste of Conquest, The Rise and Fall of Three Great Cities of Spice. You can hear that show. I think that was, I forget what number that is. Joe, help me out. That was one of our past shows, Michael. Michael's not a newcomer to my show. And he also wrote Around the American Table. And the recent book that we're really going to be referring to, along with an article for Gastronomica, is Sweet Invention, A History of Dessert, which traces the rich history of sweets from Europe to India and the Middle East. And it talks about a lot of the religious and secular and metaphysical symbolism of the sweets, of many of these sweet confections. Michael has written and talked a lot about sweets, and I referred to the Gastronomica article, which was Sweets in India. And many of you might have seen the wonderful cover on Savour magazine. The whole cover article was Michael's. It was all about donuts. But today, being the Easter season, let's start off talking about some traditional Easter sweets. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you, and happy whatever holiday you want to celebrate, exactly.
Right. As I said, you know, Easter, there's so many symbolic sweets associated with Easter. And where did all this come from, and what are some of these that we might want to know about?
Well, it originates, oh dear, probably with the Babylonians or even older than that, because this is the time of rebirth. And of course, Easter is fundamentally a holiday about rebirth. It's a holiday about fertility. And the Jews and the Christians and others have piggybacked on this and added their holidays to it. And fertility, well, fertility tastes sweet, I suppose.
Okay. And
so that the idea of sweet foods have been associated with just about every holiday, but the bigger the holiday, the more sweets are associated with it. I think the desserts or sweets that Europeans typically associate with Easter, though, are various kinds of breads.
Mm-hmm.
Because bread has a very complicated meaning. In Christianity, of course, bread represents Christ.
The body of Christ.
The body of Christ. And so if that body happens to be a little bit sweeter, so much the better, instead of the dry wafers you get in church. So that the idea of having these breads for Easter comes in with Christianity. It also, however, probably dates before Christianity, because to Europeans in general, to people in the Middle East, bread has been the staff of life. And so with the coming of the new year, you start planting and you start using up the old wheat of the previous season. But of course, it isn't just regular old bread that you serve at Easter.
No.
It is deeply enriched bread. And what do you put into the bread typically is, well, that quintessential symbol of fertility, the egg.
Right.
So the more eggs, the better. The other idea with the bread, which is also very primitive, is this idea of yeast. The yeast, you make your loaf of bread, of course, and then it magically rises. Like the belly of a pregnant woman, or another pregnant animal for that matter.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So there's long been this, you know, anthropologists look at this and sort of see the rising round loaf as symbolic of fertility in that sense. Mm-hmm. And in some cultures, also remember that both Easter and Passover, Easter based on Passover, is celebrated at the first spring moon. And again, you have that round form symbolizing the moon. And in some cultures, it also represents the coming of the sun, because it is also soon after spring equinox. So it has all these multiple associations. And if you want to look at really, really, really obvious fertility associations, you can simply look to the Greek and some southern Mediterranean breads, where you take the bread and then you plait it like woman's hair. You make it into a circle, which in most cultures represents, how shall we say this? Femininity.
That's a good way to say it. Okay. A braid in a circle,
a
right?
A braid in a circle. So you've
got with it what you will.
Symbolism A, symbolism B. And then you stick eggs in it, mm-hmm. right? I mean, it is the... You don't have to be an anthropologist to see the meaning in that.
Yes, but you painted a very vivid image for us. Thank you. And then, of course, as time went on, these eggs became more festive and colored eggs. But you mentioned Greek, starting with the Greeks. And they always color their eggs
red for the passion of Christ.
Yeah, and then the death and the suffering and the
oh, sure.
and whatever,
yeah.
you know.
I mean, it is about death and rebirth. I mean, right. that's what Easter is all about.
Yeah. And it's interesting that Easter feasts, Easter sweets, I mean, what, you think about it, they've just gone through 40 days of Lent and forbidden foods. And so all of a sudden they... you know, get to bring out all the wonderful foods that they can finally eat. Dairy, eggs, meat, because we're not talking about meat today.
Of course.
Yeah,
but the other thing you have to think about is particularly with the eggs, chickens aren't laying so many eggs
traditionally
in the winter.
That's right.
So this is the first time of year when you have eggs available. But also butter, which was forbidden for the 40 days. Mm-hmm. Butter and to a lesser degree lard, but it was really the butter, so that, you know, you pile the butter into all of these sweets as well.
Put it all in one thing and call it bread.
Exactly.
It's good for you. You have
exactly.
to eat it, right? Right. Well, and there are so many different breads and beautiful breads, and we can take a trip around the world talking about these sweet breads And I can mention and start with Italy. Of course, they have the Colombo di Pasqua.
I mean, Italy is amazing, isn't it? You've got all these regional specialties, and everybody's got something else. And what I always love about Italians is that not only do they have different foods, but they have different names for the same food. So you'll be in one town, and it'll be called one thing, and another town, another thing. One of my favorites is something called a... The Venetians called a fugazza in the local dialect, or focaccia in standard Italian. And, you know, we think of a focaccia as this kind of like tomatoless, cheeseless
white pizza,
right? Right. But in fact, in Venice, they make something much more like a panettone. It's a big round, it's this round loaf that comes in various sizes. I remember going to a very traditional Venetian pasticceria. And they would have, you know, the 2 euro version, the 5 euro version, the 15 euro version, and then the 50 euro version, which was enough to feed a very large family. Mm. And it is exactly this kind of bread with tons and tons of butter, tons and tons of eggs and egg yolks in it, and you name it. There's, you know, booze in there. There's all sorts of spices, because Venetians are particularly fond of their spices. Mm-hmm. But because it is so heavily laden down with fat and eggs, the yeast doesn't work that well. And so they have to, something like 5 rises on this thing.
Wow.
Which you have to control very, very rapidly. I've tried replicating this recipe, and there is actually a recipe in Sweet Invention for it. But you have to be patient. Again, I was talking to the pastry shop owner, and he was saying, yeah, nobody wants to make these anymore because you have to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning to look after the yeast.
Yeah, indeed. And is that, I'm not familiar with the Venetian variety. Does it have dried fruits in it?
It doesn't have dried fruits.
Okay.
The main difference between it and the panettone is the shape. Mm-hmm. This one is much more of a round loaf shape. It's got a little bit of sides to it, but it doesn't have that tall, what you describe as sort of that columnar.
Like a toque, like a chef's toque.
Like a chef toque shape. Yeah. So it is much more sort of like a loaf.
Mm-hmm. Well, the traditional Colombo di Pasqua throughout the rest of Italy is also just like a panettone cake without any of the dried fruits and just, but plain.
Right, but in the shape of a dove.
Shape of a dove, right. Sprinkled
Colomba
with sugar.
Colomba in
right.
Italian, yeah.
And so. Interesting. I didn't realize that the meaning behind sfogliatelle, and that being because of the many layers that was associated with fertility. The sfogliatelle.
You know, I don't know about this. Tell me about this.
I just read about it in one of the books and doing some preparation. I was reading, I was saying, well, what? I should know some of these other things from Italy, having lived there for so long. And I thought, well, sfogliatelle, you get them all year round now, but traditionally they were made during the spring, and particularly for Easter, because of the ricotta, that they would fill it with a ricotta cream. Well, of course, lambs are
right.
You know, being born, the sheeps have milk, and they're...
And again, the ricotta was forbidden during the 40
right,
days.
Right.
Of course, one of the funny things about that is that, you know, one culture adapts another culture. And the sfogliatelle is very much of an Arabic technique. In fact, there's an Arabic recipe for virtually the same thing from about the 12th, 13th century. And that method of making the layers is very much, there's very old, sort of early medieval recipes for making that pasta sfogliata, that special pasta.
Dough, yeah.
Because I don't know if you're aware of how it's made, but it's basically made by... whereas traditional French pâte feuilletée or how you say it in your country? Puff pastry.
Right.
Puff pastry is made by basically folding in half dough over and over and over, and over, actually in thirds, dough over and over with
lots
butter,
of butter
in between. The dough for sfogliatelle is made by smearing warm butter on a sheet of dough, rolling it up, and then rolling
it
out.
Rolling it, right.
A very different technique and very much of an Arabic technique.
Interesting. Though we mentioned ricotta, and of course another traditional Easter sweet is the ricotta pie.
Or the Venetian
cheesecake.
Right,
yeah,
right.
And that, again, the sheep's milk from, you know, birthing lambs, and again, you know, the rebirth and fertility. It's all these things. Okay, jelly beans. What about well, they're eggs, right?
They are.
Candy came into, you know, came into being and associated with Easter, chocolate, and of course, just in recreating the shapes of all those things that were representative and symbolic of birth and
well, I love how these things become completely disassociated from their origins,
yeah.
Right? I mean, chocolate bunnies. Of course we all have chocolate bunnies for Easter.
Why
do we have chocolate bunnies for Easter? And why do chocolate bunnies bring eggs?
Eggs, right. And if you think about it too hard, it could be a little frightening. Why is this rabbit coming into my house depositing eggs, right? But indeed, I mean, the rabbit is associated with fertility, right?
The rabbit couldn't be more pagan in that sense.
Right. We all know that they breed like bunnies, right?
They do, those chocolate eggs.
Yeah. But interesting, I mean, and over time it became associated with the Virgin Mary, only because I think there was somebody had written that they thought the hare, not, you know, rabbit, but the hare, could reproduce without losing virginity, so to speak. And so they eventually led to, you know, in later
right, so
centuries.
These, so
you know.
These things become so unbelievably convoluted.
Oh, the lore. Right,
yeah,
the lore
absolutely.
Behind it.
But this whole idea of sort of the symbolic eating of, you know, objects or animals and so on and so on. This too, well, this goes back to the Roman days, of course, where they would make breads sweetened with honey, usually, because they didn't really have sugar, sweetened with honey in the shape of male sexual organs, which they would presumably eat at the end of the meal. Well, not presumably. They would eat at the end of the meal to give them more energy for other activities. And there's all these various breast-shaped sweets.
Oh, yeah.
Not only do you have these in Sicily today, but you have referenced these things in ancient Greece as well, these sort of breast-shaped sweets.
And in France as well, you know, the the nuns, the breasts of the nuns, and whatever else they have.
Yeah, which is also a little bit macabre, and it also relates to this whole idea of kind of the virginal, I don't know, virginal virtuous thing that you eat and somehow imbibe that thing. And it is very primitive and almost totemic, because there were, particularly when it comes to gingerbread, they would make all sorts of things with gingerbread, right? And this whole idea of making bunnies, for example.
Yeah, we were talking about that before the show, thinking, well, they wouldn't have made, in the 17th century, would not have made a chocolate molded bunny rabbit. And you mentioned that possibly gingerbread.
Right. It's most likely that it comes from gingerbread, because in Germany, in, let's say, the late Middle Ages, the early Renaissance, they would create all these fantastic molds. There are museums devoted to these molds, these elaborately carved molds of for gingerbread. And they began with saints in them, you know, so that you would put, the Dutch still do this, they put St. Nicholas and make a gingerbread St. Nicholas. And then you eat the saint, right? And in eating the saint, you become more saintly, which is the same idea as eating the host at the Christian Mass. You actually eat the blood and flesh. Well, you drink the blood, but eat the flesh of, you know, the living Lord.
Right.
And that somehow makes you more holy. Well, this would become turned into St. Nicholas, or it become much more pagan than that. So you would have... You'd eat a bunny if you wanted to become more fertile.
Mm-hmm.
You'd eat a cockerel if you wanted to be more virile. I guess that's the right term.
Or aggressive, yeah. Aggressive or virile, right.
Right. And then there were various sort of saints' legs, feet, ears that were created so that you could nibble on, you know, a saint's ear and become... more saintly, I suppose.
Yummy. I think on that note, we're going to take a short break, but this is fascinating, and I want to hear so much more when we come back on A Taste of the Past.
Grass-fed beef, pasture-raised on 150,000 acres in Central California. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, free-range, sustainably produced, humane. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, the authentic flavor of the American West.
Hi, we're back talking with Michael Crandall about Easter sweets and symbolism of pagan sweets as well as religious sweets. And we can't forget hot cross buns.
Of course.
Wow,
of
course. Yeah.
Yeah, hot cross buns. I mean, they're so much like all those other Easter breads and cakes, in that they've got all these spices in them, right? Which, of course, goes back to the Middle Ages.
And puffy yeast dough.
And they're puffy yeast dough. At one point looked into the hot cross bun issue, and it's unclear how old they are. They used to be eaten actually for Good Friday. And then they kind of spread through the entire Lent, which is sort of ironic because in most cases, the sweetbreads are only eaten after Lent.
After Lent, right.
But it may well be that the British weren't really into Lent so much. Henry VIII got rid of Lent.
That's right.
And so they now became traditional for the entire period of Lent. And the oldest reference I could find to them was from the 18th century.
Oh, yeah.
Where they said something about going downstairs to eat with the servants who had made the hot cross buns. So they've been around. And they used to be hawked on the street. There's all those, I forget the limerick now, but hot cross buns, two a penny, three a penny, right. Hot cross buns, which apparently showed up, I think, in, I'll say Bath in in England, but I'm not sure that's quite right.
Mm. Well, I found some reference to pan de Ramarino. You and I were talking about that before the show. I asked you if you had heard about it. They sound to me an awful lot like what we know of as hot cross buns, except the cross, they're small yeast, or yeah, I believe yeast, I don't know if it's a quick bread or yeast, a sweetened dough, but it has a, for the cross, is rosemary. So it symbolizes the body, what is it, the body of Christ, and then the rosemary symbolizes the oils that Christ would have been bathed in before his burial, something. I had never heard reference to that before.
And so, it's fascinating because you don't find really so many Italian breads with rosemary in them, right?
Exactly.
Rosemary is usually associated with savory food in Italy.
As we're talking about focaccia, on a savory focaccia.
Yeah, sure,
but, not in a sweet. No, that's not true. Sweet, I'm just thinking. Chestnut cake. It's lightly sweet. It's sort of a combination between a savory and a sweet.
Right,
and
right.
It has it's made with rosemary in it.
So one of the funny interesting things in Italy is that when I was working on the book, I was trying to figure out, okay, what is a bread and what is a dessert? And we in English have an idea of what that means. But in Italy, these focaccias, these panettone, all of these sweet breads are never sold at the bakery. They're never sold by the bakers. They're sold by the pasticcere, at the pastry shop. So in the Italian mind, these are not breads. These are cakes, in much the same way that traditionally the French thought of brioche, which is the same idea, right, as a cake, as in let them eat cake. as a cake rather than a bread. And it's a sort of a funny distinction. When I was growing up, I grew up in what's now the Czech Republic. And for Easter, there were two different things that we had. We had something called a mazanet, which is very much one of these yeast-raised breads with lots of candied fruit in it. It is round, and it is studded with almonds. And I don't know what that studding with almonds refers to. I'm sure it refers to something like, the crown of thorns or something
like that. And almonds are very much a part of a lot of, I think, the spring and Easter dishes. I don't know why.
I think it's just that they were expensive because they were imported.
So, yes.
Right. I mean, all the Christmas desserts seem to have walnuts in them, and the spring desserts seem to have almonds because they were just expensive and imported, just like the sugar was expensive. And eggs, too. Eggs used to be extremely expensive if you bought them yourself. If you raised them, it was one thing, but an egg would have been the equivalent of a dollar in those days. An egg. So we had these mazanets, these sort of round loaves, but then we also had these molded Easter lamb cakes. And everybody would have one of these molds. The older ones, the traditional ones, were made out of earthenware. And the more recent ones were made out of tin or something
like aluminum,
that.
Right.
Yeah. And then there was sort of like a distinction about what kind of a cake you were going to make. Again, the older cake was made with a yeast dough. So it was kind of like a panettone type of dough. You would pour the dough in this, it would rise, you would bake it, and so on. And then you would glaze it with some sort of a sugar glaze and put two raisins into the eyes and that sort of thing. And then there was a sponge cake version. And of course, the great fun at dinner is that you slice into the lamb. I mean, you are sacrificing the lamb, the sugary lamb. Of course, the Italians have much the same thing, right? Except that there is usually marzipan.
Right.
But again, almonds, interestingly enough.
Yeah. The almonds come into it. In Polish, there's they still make the, in Poland, it's a Polish tradition as well to have the Easter lamb cake.
Uh-huh.
I guess lamb on the table, lamb.
And do you happen to know how they make that?
No.
Okay.
But my sister had asked me to please go to, you know, the New York Baking Company or something to find a mold. She couldn't find a lamb mold. Now they're, that, this was years ago, now they're all over the place.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You
yeah.
can
yeah.
find
yeah.
them. They've come back into fashion. Let's talk about the Pascha.
Well, as you get further north and east from where I grew up, you get all sorts of these. Again, I mean, it's basically a panettone, but all these sorts.
Well, think about the name. Pascha. It's a cake, a bread, a sweet bread, but it sounds like Pasqua or Pesach.
It comes directly from Latin. Paschal lamb, yes. Yeah. I mean, it is specifically an Easter dessert, so Pascha. And I'm not sure how widely disseminated it is because it sort of depends a little bit where you are in Eastern Europe. But I know that in the Ukraine, they have make these Paschas, and they're often decorated with all sorts of really pagan symbols. You know, they put a sun on them. They put sheaves of wheat. They put pussy willows. You know, all these signs of, again, spring.
Like
spring
a marshmallow
labor.
Peep.
Like a marshmallow peep.
Okay.
But a slightly older version. And then, of course, you make this incredibly pagan bread. And then apparently, traditionally, they would swaddle this in infant swaddling cloth, you know, like the baby Jesus, or like an infant. And then they would bring it to church to have it blessed before eating it. So, you know, once more, this idea of rebirth just so graphically depicted, and this blending of, I guess, Orthodox in their case and pagan ritual all in one. That's what Easter is, right?
That is. That's right. That's right. It all brought it back. And so many, I'm sure if we looked into other cultures, there are so many other foods that hold such symbolism such as that. And it's interesting to delve into that. And I know that we can find out a lot more if we look at your book called Sweet Invention, The History of Dessert. I'm sure you have a lot of goodies tucked in there for us to find around.
If you look at these, many of these desserts, because sweet things used to be rare and expensive, they were often associated with the priest class. So that apparently in ancient Babylonia, you would have priests who were specifically, whose job was to make sweet meats or sweet cakes. Of course, they weren't using sugar. They were using dates and honey and those sorts of things. But then when you go to India, Indians... In India, in the same way that maybe bread is sacred in the West, in India it is milk. Milk is the sacred ingredient. And specifically anything that comes from a cow, of course, to a Hindu is sacred.
That's right, right.
So not only is it, you know, the things that we would think to eat, but also things we would not think to eat are considered the liquids that are produced by a cow. And one of the most sacred ones is butter. So that be butter or rendered ghee. So basically anything you cook in ghee becomes holy.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, all the holidays that they have around the year, whether it's Diwali, which is the big sort of sweet blowout that usually happens sometime in the fall, anything that you fry, bake, cook with a little bit of butter in it, with a little bit of this ghee in it, becomes naturally sacred, naturally holy, and then you can kind of give it to others. I remember being in Calcutta when I was doing research for the book, and I happened to be there during Kali Puja. Kali Puja is a puja is a holiday, basically. But a Kali Puja coincides with what they have Diwali everywhere else in India, but not in Bengal, where they have something different. And you go to the temple, and at the temple, there are two things that you are supposed to bring to the goddess. One is hibiscus blossoms, because they're blood red, and Kali is a bit of a bloodthirsty goddess. She likes hibiscus flowers. But the other thing is something called peda, which is I always think of it as like a space ration. It is essentially milk cooked down with sugar. So that it is this highly concentrated, and it's these little discs, almost fudge-like discs.
Okay, dulce de leche or something.
They're not as caramelized as that. They control the caramelization process more. So it's more like, think evaporated milk or condensed milk turned into a pellet. And then you cook these down, you spice them with a little bit of cardamom. And they are this almost primitive, like, fudge. And you can almost see, you know, the gods up in Olympus or the Hindu equivalent nibbling on these as a quick pick-me-up.
Interesting. Well, I'm sure that there's a whole other show in that. And going to India alone, if I remember from your article in Gastronomica, it was terrific. And I look forward. Oh, tell me, you are going to be working with Dara Goldstein, another one of our guests on the show here, on a new edition of companion to the Oxford Encyclopedia on sweets, right?
We are putting together, or I should say Dara is putting together, and I'm her man Friday there. We're putting together a companion to sweets, which will have, I think, something like 1,000 entries of sweets around the world. We're getting experts from around the world to contribute, and it should be an astonishing volume when we finally edit it and publish it, which will probably be 2 years, maybe, yeah. If we're lucky.
Okay, hopefully we'll still be around and we can have you both on and talk about that. And I look forward to your new book coming out, Donuts, because we can do another show about donuts.
That'll be fun.
That would be wonderful. Well, Michael, thank you so much for joining me today. It has been enlightening.
You are so welcome.
And I wish everyone a great holiday, whatever holidays you're celebrating, and eat some sweets and think of the meaning.
Absolutely.
Thanks for joining. I'm Linda Palaccio, and this has been A Taste of the Past.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.